Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Cleo Stiller, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If this is your first time, thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. This is episode 74 of the show, and it features a conversation with an author and journalist named Cleo Stiller, who wrote the book Modern Manhood, Conversations about the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. It was released in November of 2019. So, if you've been listening to the show, you know I've done a segment recently coming up on the second installment called Getting Real About Manhood with my friend and colleague, Ed Tilton. And as we started to prepare to do these episodes together, I started reading this book and I sent him a link to it. And the next thing you know, he had reached out to Cleo on Instagram and invited her to be on the podcast. So we had a couple conversations. Ed and I spoke to her together over Zoom to kind of break the ice. And then I interviewed her for this last week. And the following episode after this will be an installment of Getting Real About Manhood, where Ed and I kind of break down some of the things we talked about with Cleo. So, as we get started here, I thought I'd read at least the beginning of the introduction of the book. It starts, "Here are three self-evident truths. The Harvey Weinsteins of the world need to go. Sexual assault is wrong. And women and men should be on equal footing. If you disagree with any of the aforementioned, then this book isn't for you. But if you're still here, you're probably one of the good guys, and you're probably feeling frustrated and exasperated, or simply thinking WTF when it comes to the current national conversation surrounding hashtag MeToo, masculinity, and the relationship between women and men. You might even have rolled your eyes at a group text with your friends or while you were scrolling through Facebook or Twitter and said, this has all just gone a little too far. Not that you'd openly cop to that in real life for fear of getting chewed out. If so, then this book is for you, because you get it. But you've also likely found yourself in countless experiences or conversations recently where the situation feels gray at best. For example, who hasn't had a date like Aziz Ansari? Or, as a manager, how are you supposed to mentor your female employees in this climate? Or if this is a post-Me Too world, how come men are often still shamed for making less than their female partners? Can you still watch Louis C.K.? How come you're always being made to feel like crap if you ask these questions out loud? And when do we start talking about solutions instead of just putting people down? Welcome to Modern Manhood. This book is a manual and a resource that I hope will shed some light on all the gray areas out there, focusing on conversations you are already having with your friends, your dates, your family, and yourself. Each chapter will cover a different area of your personal life, from money and sex to dating and work. I've talked to experts, celebrities, and influencers, and folks just like yourself to see what other people are thinking and doing about these exact questions. So you can think of this book as a crowdsourced document of sorts. It's not prescriptive and it has no rules. You can take what you like and leave what you don't. So it's an interesting book. And in this conversation, we talk about some of the things that Cleo learned. And I really appreciate her generosity of time with this and Ed making it happen. So here you go. Cleo Stiller.
Just the product of some bad seeds.
Cleo, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I had an espresso probably a little too late in the day, so yes. I'm a little jittery right now, but it tasted really good.
I totally understand that. I try to cut myself off around 2 or 3 p.m. Otherwise, I can get too chatty.
Yeah.
Too late in the day.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. And, you know, we had a conversation a while back. You're the author of the book Modern Manhood, Conversations About the Complicated World of Being a Good Man Today. So, you know, this is one of my favorite topics. I feel like it's something that as men, we need, and I've talked about it a lot on this podcast, actually. I feel like as men, we need to do a much better job of teaching each other how to be men. Mm. And in my work, it's become something that I've begun to focus on a lot, both personally and with clients of mine. And what I loved about seeing your book is that you mentioned being a good man, because I think that is a very important part of it. So tell me how you came to write this book.
Sure, absolutely. So a lot of folks on first glance see the title of the book, Modern Manhood, then see my name and look at me and they're like, what is a woman doing writing a book called Modern Manhood? And I think that's a really fair question. And here's the answer. So for many years, I hosted a television show for Univision's cable network called Fusion. And the show was called Sex Right Now with Cleo Stiller. Mm-hmm. Obviously, a very provocative title, got a lot of eyeballs. But the show talked about, was very scientifically rigorous and talked about the intersections of technology, pop culture, and shifting social attitudes among millennials, Gen Z, and below, younger. Mm-hmm. So we had this show going. We had rapport with our audience. We had trust with our audience that new things that were popping up for them in their personal lives, stuff relating to online dating, reproductive rights, we were capturing them first. And we were saying, listen, here's how this is going down all over the country. Here's what it looks like in the South. Here's how folks in LA are handling it. And here is the scientifically health accurate information that you need to make informed decisions in your personal life. So that was the show. And our audience was split about 50-50 men and women. So then 2017 happens, right? The Harvey Weinstein scandal breaks and Me Too, as most people know it, hits the mainstream. Mm-hmm. At that point, a lot of men who watched my show started writing into me, are you going to do a season on this? Because I have so much to say about what's happening right now, but I'm kind of afraid to say anything because I don't want to get in trouble. And it's all just really confusing. And for the most part, there was this overall, you know, sentiment I really support the underpinnings of the Me Too movement, you know, grotesque abuses of power and of women and men is obviously wrong. And people like Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby, etc., get them out of the way. But then the way that Me Too, as it continued to impact our lives in somewhat unexpected ways, became very confusing for men. And they were like, I was on board with it. Now I'm not so sure. Some men said it hadn't gone far enough. Some men said it had gone too far. But this overall trend I was hearing from guys is they wanted to talk about it, right? They had a lot to say. It was impacting their lives. They were texting their guy friends on group texts. They were kind of like fumbling around like with their partners, trying to like say something without getting in the doghouse. And they had real questions like, I'm a single guy and I'm terrified to approach women now. I feel like everything I was taught to do is now considered creepy or worse. I had new parents writing into me. I'm a young father. I just had my first son. I don't even know what it means to raise a good man anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Or we had, you know, managers, right, writing in saying like, listen, I won't cop to this on the record, but I have a lot of hiring power. And to be totally honest, I don't want to hire new female staff. It doesn't right. seem worth the risk. And so this kind of piled up in my inbox for 2 years. And eventually a publisher came to me and was like, we wanted you to do a book with you. And I was like, it's got to be this, because this is the story of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And prior to COVID, it was.
Yeah. I've noticed how, in some ways I've kind of felt silly talking about anything else besides the Black Lives Matter stuff right now, because it's so prevalent.
Yes.
But I also think that there are some commonalities here, because when you mentioned men feeling confused and afraid that they're going to say something wrong, I mean, that's something that I can personally relate to with racism. And, and just because of my history, I mean, I don't think I come from the most racist family in the world. You know, I kind of had one parent who would say the wrong things and another one who would yell at him for saying those things. So I kind of had both sides, but, you know, I think it's one of the big reasons why white Americans have a hard time with this white privilege thing, because we don't want to think of ourselves as bad people.
Yes.
You know, that is what has held me back at times from having these conversations more with people of color than with white people. You know, I do want to be regarded as, I am an ally. You know, it's a scary thing. It has been a scary thing. And one of the things I love about what's happening now is it's opening up these conversations that were, you know, not taking place before. I feel like more people feel safe to talk about it than did before. And I love that. It's a great thing, because until we, you know, have that disinfectant of sunlight on this, nothing substantive is really going to change, you know?
Well, in that way, I agree. There are parallels to be drawn between the conversation that Me Too brings up and the conversation that protest, police brutality, and Black Lives Matter brings up. That, you know, the reason I wrote the book Modern Manhood is because I had been covering women's health for years. And the only people that cared about women's health were women.
Right.
And only some of them, not even all of them.
Right.
So when I saw that all these men now cared, they were interested, the veil had dropped, so to speak, in some ways.
Mm.
And I saw that even though they were interested and wanted to participate in the conversation, they were feeling shut out. And I didn't want to miss the opportunity to call them in to the conversation so that men, women, folks of all genders or non-binary can work together to decide how we want to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to miss that opportunity, right? And so, and I see this now too happening with what's going on in our country right now, that prior to having all of this atrocities on tape where you can't look away,
right,
it was much easier for many folks to deny its existence. And so now that they see it and they are participating in the conversation, it's so critical now because we can't make real change unless everyone gets involved. Right. So, yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are true parallels to these conversations for sure.
Including, you know, and I mentioned this to you in another conversation, privilege.
Yeah.
Because, you know, although I do agree, and, you know, listen, I'm a guy who's, I've worked on myself for decades at this point. You know, trying to be the best human being I could be and the best man I could be and just evaluating how I show up in romantic relationships and really challenging myself. So, and learning. And, you know, to me, when I hear you talk about the confusion on the part of men is what they can say, what they can do, what hiring practices, stuff like that. I mean, to me, the confusion is about having to employ a filter that they've never used before. Because, you know, suddenly we have to be careful about what we say to women because it's not acceptable like it was, you know, before. And so this, it's, I do think it's a real thing, the confusion, but I think we need to take a look at why it actually exists. It's actually a clear example of the privilege that, that, we have as men enjoyed for a long time.
You'll get no argument from me there, my friend. You'll get no argument from me there.
So, we also talked about, you know, these terms like male privilege and toxic masculinity that you sort of have gone out of your way to avoid using. Talk about that.
Well, I think, okay. Let me start. So when I started this book, I'm fortunate in that I have been a reporter for enough years that people trust me with their personal stories.
Mm-hmm.
So people came to me, men came to me to say, oh, I heard you're doing this book. Thank God, because I have a story for you. Okay. Hear me out on this. And I'm lucky that that is the case. However, some instances where men didn't approach me and I had to go out of my way to get these interviews, I knew that if I used certain terms that just have a reputation, a connotation in popular culture, I was not going to get anywhere with these folks, right?
Right.
And I don't really know anyone that likes the term toxic masculinity, even people who use it, even, you know, cisgendered women who use it. I wouldn't say they love that term. I think it's just sort of become this, like, it's easy because everyone knows what it means and you can just throw it out there.
Mm-hmm.
But to men who may fall under some loose definition of toxic masculinity, which is really the people you want to be reaching, right?
Mm-hmm.
You say that term and you are done. Like, case closed, hang up the phone, right? And that's not the point. Like, that's not helpful right now.
Mm-hmm.
So what I really wanted this book to be was a book that sort of said to guys, okay, I hear you. And guess what? You're not alone here. Mm-hmm. People like you, or actually very different than you, all over the country are kind of feeling a similar way. Here's how they're handling it. Here's how we got here. Here's some historical context to this that you don't know. No, mm-hmm. People don't know so much about why we behave the way we behave in everyday life, but there's a lot of history behind it, a lot of science behind it. And so I wanted to give folks that information so they read it for themselves and they're like, oh, shit. Okay. You know, pardon my language, but, you know, really like let that sink in. Mm-hmm. And then I trust most of my readers to come away with it and use that information to inform their future behavior.
Mm-hmm.
But if you smack toxic masculinity like anywhere on that book cover, I told my publisher this. I was like, nowhere on the book cover, nowhere in the press. It's nowhere in my manuscript, because then it becomes a book for a completely different audience. Yeah. And that those are not the people.
A smaller audience. To. Right,
a
right.
A much smaller audience who don't really need to read the book anyway, you know?
Yeah. You know, and language is, I mean, words are so powerful. Yeah. They really are.
Yeah.
And I mean, I totally get, I use that approach in my life all the time with different things, you know, especially being an addiction counselor where, you know, a lot of people don't want to hear about the 12 steps, but you know, they work. So I end up I stay away from the jargon. I talk about the philosophy. And then when I've captured the audience, then I can say, you know what this is. This is like third step work. And by that time, it's okay.
Yes.
But especially as the age of onset with addiction gets younger and younger, I mean, young guys don't want to hear about that stuff. So anyway, but you know, back to the toxic masculinity thing. What troubles me about it more than anything else is that it is such a controversial topic, because I think, and you mentioned that everybody kind of knows what it means. And I think that's in some ways that's true, but part of the problem is that we don't really know what it means. Mm-hmm. And this is something that I've seen over the years in different ways and different subject matter, where if there's a controversial topic and you know, a word, a term like toxic masculinity, if you bring it up in a group of people, suddenly they can't hear anything else. So, you know, what a lot of men hear when you use the term toxic masculinity is masculinity is bad, which that's not the point. That's not what toxic masculinity is about. Is that, you know, to me, what it's about is that, you know, there's repressed emotion. There's, you know, we don't know how to deal with ourselves in a comprehensive way. And that manifests itself in fear that we don't know how to deal with. And so we end up, you know, showing this sort of dominance or whatever that really isn't rooted in confidence. It's not rooted in anything positive. It's rooted in fear. And that's not the same as masculinity. Yes. And, you know, my thing, this is my little phrase I've come up with to express this, is masculinity is to toxic masculinity what money is to monopoly money. So like, it's true. Toxic masculinity is not masculinity. It's the opposite of masculinity. It's the absence of power. It's the like, you know, I mean, because if you're really confident and grounded as a man, you don't need that. You know, you don't need to show dominance. You don't need to mistreat others or, yeah. So to me, comparing the two is like, you know, it's the difference between real money and fake money.
Yes. 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 I completely agree with that. And also that like a more enriched conversation about quote unquote toxic masculinity really quickly reveals like it's not just this narrative of some men are bad to some women. Mm-hmm. It's also that behavior, that sort of those expectations that we put on men hurts men. Mm-hmm. It's not good for men either. And what I did hear from a lot of men, that is frankly the, you know, a lot of people ask me like, as a reporter, as a woman, what did you find most surprising in the book? And I will say, I was surprised by a lot of things because I have traditionally reported on sort of either the experiences of men and women in a single situation or just through the female health lens. Mm-hmm. And so focusing only on men, I learned a tremendous amount, of course. But one of the most surprising to me was how much pain and anger and isolation men are feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And it is heartbreaking.
Yeah. It actually makes me happy to hear you say that.
Yeah.
Because that's, to me, that's what all this is about. Because one of the things that really baffles me is that somehow we've arrived at this place in our culture where we think we have labeled emotion as inherently feminine.
Yes.
And that is a total crock of shit. It is. I mean,
it's absurd.
You know,
it is absurd.
It is absurd. I mean, emotions are gender neutral.
Yeah.
So we are groomed from day one to not feel. And that is just it. I mean, science shows us that you will die sooner because you do that. I mean, we carry this stuff around in our bodies and men suffer in silence.
Yes.
You know, and yes. When like Thoreau said so long ago, the mass of men lead lives of quiet desperation. It's true.
Yes.
It really is true. And it's such a shame. And you know, one of the things I'm really compelled to do is like, just turn that whole idea upside down of only women are supposed to feel. And again, the language is really important because, you know, if we use words like passion and vitality, I mean, think about how our emotions motivate us and inspire us to do things. And what we don't understand a lot of times as human beings, and especially as men, is that we don't get to filter out the negative emotions and then feel the positive ones. If I can't be sad, I can't, by the same token, I can't feel joy.
Yes. Yes.
We're numbing ourselves. That's what we're doing completely.
And the numbness. So like I did ask men, you know, I had a sort of list of 20 questions that I asked everyone I interviewed. And one of them is, you know, what's one emotion that you feel pretty comfortable expressing?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer was rage.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, I heard from several guys, like, you know, nothing really bothers me. I've got tough skin. Like, I can pretty take pretty much take anything on the chin. And I'm like, okay, I get that. I get, you know, that make you're a tough guy. Things don't bother you. But, you know, like, when do you really feel something? And then they're like, well, you push me. And then I snap. Mm-hmm. And that I heard over and over again. And it's true that the one emotion that we sanction as masculine and therefore like, or manly, it's mm-hmm. okay, is rage. Yeah. And like, damn, if that doesn't call up memories for you or feel of people you know, and also what a way to go through the world like that. No, we must do better than that. That's, yeah,
absolutely. And, you know, for me, this, when Anthony Bourdain committed suicide, that hit me like a ton of bricks. Because he's someone who I just looked at him like, man, what a cool life. And I wrote a little piece about it too, because, you know, like, I mean, I love the way he dressed and, you know, I related to him. And also I thought, what a great life. What a, you know, and to me, like, you know, this podcast essentially is about helping people learn how to have the life that they want to have. I mean, that's, and to me, that's, I mean, he traveled the world experiencing cultures and, you know, immersing himself in these communities. And it just seemed so cool. Like, and then all of a sudden he's gone. And I just, I was mad. You know, I was mad. And as I think I remember hearing about it on a Friday, and then by the time Sunday rolled around, it hit me why it bothered me so much. And it's because, you know, I've lost friends to suicide, in my young adulthood, late adolescence. And it just tapped into that and brought it all up to the surface. And the common thread, all guys, all going through stuff that they were sad about or ashamed of and didn't know how to talk about it. They didn't know what to do with it. And so then, you know, they make that ultimate final decision and end it all. I mean, it just, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. And, you know, they're all guys who, great personalities, all, you know, just could have done anything they wanted with their lives. And we're just so young. Besides, you know, of course, Anthony Bourdain wasn't like this, but my friends, they were too young to understand. They didn't have a clear frame of reference of, you know, life isn't over because this girl moved on, you know, kind of stuff. Ugh. Or, you know, life isn't over because you got in so much trouble you couldn't have a senior year or whatever, you know. And it just, you know, because things are so heavy to kids, everything feels so permanent emotionally. Yes. And it just, like, I don't want, if I can do something to prevent that from happening, I want to do that, you know. So that, to me, that's what all this stuff about manhood is really about. And the truth is that, you know, it's so hard as guys, most guys, like, cannot talk about what's going on with them. They can't.
No.
Like,
no.
And if they do, like, the world I come from, if you did, it was over drinks.
Yes.
And so, you know, when you carry around a bunch of crap and you never know how to talk, I mean, sooner or later, that's like a lot of drinks, you know, that you have to consume to deal with. And like, it's a dead end, you know, that was part of my experience too. Like, and it doesn't have to be that hard. And the other part is we look at it as a culture, we look at vulnerability in men as a weakness. And the truth is, it actually takes a lot of courage. Like, to sit in a room full of guys and be completely real, like real enough to shed a tear, that takes guts.
Yes.
It really does. And so it's we really have it all backwards as men. And, you know, to me, it goes back to the language thing. We got to find a way to frame it for the guys who don't want to hear about toxic masculinity in order to really reach them. Can you tell I'm into this stuff?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to say that for me, it was really interesting. So each chapter of the book is a different area of your personal life: dating, money, work, friendship, parenting, yourself. And interestingly, friendship ended up being the most surprising, meaty, juicy chapter. Like, I'll be honest, certainly not the chapter I was most interested in writing. But what I learned while reporting that is that, you know, you were saying, like, for a guy, for some men to emote, you know, like, what's really going on to that for them, to their friends, that's like 4, 5 to 10 beers, you know, in before that kind of thing comes out. And there's a reason for that. And it's actually extremely common. Like, you know, I think a lot about how there's a running joke in my family, like, dad has no friends.
Yeah.
And then you get older and you realize, oh, your family too? Your dad has no friends? Because my mom has a ton of friends. Mm-hmm. And my dad just has my mom. And my mom will always, like, set up play dates for my dad just to try to get him to, like, you know, interact with other men. And it's a joke. But when it happens on a wide scale, you kind of have to step back and look and say, like, what's going on? And a lot of men will say, I got your mother. You know, I don't need, right?
Right.
So the question that we were getting, or I was getting from a lot of guys happening right now, was kind of like, basically went like this. They'd be like, listen, I've got a friend. We've all got this friend, right? Who says, like, sexist, racist stuff. And it used to feel okay. Like, we'd kind of like laugh it off or whatever, even though no one agreed with them, but like, we'll just shrug it off. But now with everything going on, I don't really feel like I can let him off the hook with this. But on the other hand, I don't want to, like, call him out and then, A, either, like, have him think I'm weak or, like, a pussy, right? I heard that a lot. Or, like, have him be like, what? Like, you've never said anything? What, are you perfect?
Mm-hmm.
And I heard this over and over again from guys, and I was like, wow, this must be really happening a lot. So the question there is, why do men do locker room talk? Like, what's that about? And the reason why men do locker room talk is because when girls and boys are quite young, they form friendships in very similar ways. Everyone on the playground is hugging, kissing. They're like whispering to each other, telling each other all their little kid secrets without thought of what does this look like? Or, you know, they're all emotionally very deeply bonding with their friends. And then quite early on, young boys start getting policed by their teachers, by their brothers or sisters, by their parents, being like, hey, don't lean on your friend like that. Okay. Don't hug your friend like that. You're a boy. That's a girl thing. Girls have good friends. Okay. Boys, stand apart. You know, you're a boy, you're on your own. And they get that messaging so consistently and at such an early age that I talked to one researcher. Her name is Naomi Wei. She has this really interesting social experiment where she gets boys, teen boys, going from eighth grade into high school freshman year. She'll pull them aside and she'll say, "So who's your best friend?" And he, you know, the boy can say without a doubt, "Oh, my best friend is so-and-so." And she'll be like, "Okay, well, what do you guys talk about?" And we'll say, like, "I don't know, like, everything." And she'll push him on it. "Okay, well, like, what is everything? Like, I don't know, like, school, girls, like, my parents' divorce, my dad lost his job." Okay, so that's a lot, right? That's kind of the full spectrum. Then she checks in with these same boys consistently each year as they move through high school, so sophomore, junior, senior year. And by the time she gets them as senior year, she asks them those same questions. And those conversations that used to be so deep and vulnerable, they're not having them anymore. That best friend is now like a bud. And there's like more of a group of guys and we kind of hang out. Like, what do you guys talk about? I don't know, like sports, cars. And that, so what happens is men get told, don't talk to your friends about anything deep or emotionally vulnerable. So that when men are adults and we're like, well, why are you only talking locker room talk with your guy friends? Duh, because that's what we told them to do from a very young age. Right. And I talked to guys who were kind of like, listen, I know it's not like PC to talk about porn or whatever, but like, that's all I got. What else am I going to talk about? You know?
Mm-hmm.
So this is this catch-22 that we put men in, where on the one hand, as we're raising them, we tell them, don't talk about your feelings. And so then they forget to talk about their feelings. And they also forget that they have feelings, because if you don't verbalize an experience, that's one of the ways we process things, right? So if you're not verbalizing it, then you're not processing it. So then all of a sudden you're like, I don't know, do I feel anything at all?
Well, really sad parts of this is what actually happens is that, I mean, for me, I've experienced this, and I assume it happens with a lot of men that, okay, I'm feeling something distressing. Then we have shame. We shame ourselves for feeling in the first place, it just snowballs. It just keeps getting worse. And it's critical to learn to deal with this stuff. And so I saw a meme a while back. It was some Australian guy or something. And he was making reference to how we teach guys not to talk about their feelings and to carry this stuff around, repress all this stuff. Of course they beat their wives. Of course they kick their dogs. Like, you know, I mean, I'm not co-signing that stuff, but that's what's going to happen, because the reality is, always comes out some way or another. It either comes out in addiction or abuse or, you know, it's something. And if we don't manage those emotions, they come out in messy, yucky, sideways rage. Like you mentioned, anger's good. Anger's a motivator. Rage isn't cool. You know, smashing shit.
Yes. This is the saying that kept coming to mind over and over again when I reported this book was, hurt people hurt people. And I also just want to tell people, like, though this book deals with a lot of serious topics, it also is not, it's not going to, like, it's light in tone, and not all of the content is this intense, because I didn't, it's not, that's not the only thing that I revealed about modern manhood is this pure isolation, but it is such a significant portion of it that it was honestly alarming, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I could see why as a woman, you just don't expect that. You wouldn't expect it. No. And guys, we don't acknowledge it very well at all. And but I will second what you're saying about your book, because, I mean, it covers kind of everything, but it does it in more of a light way. It's not all heavy stuff like this. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the benefits of you approaching it as a journalist. You can detach from it a little bit, and it's not as intense.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes.
So, yeah. But, so what's next?
What's next? Well, we may be developing the book into a television show.
Wow.
So look forward to that. I mean, you know, we don't know. These things always take forever, and so often they don't happen. So that, you know, but that's what I'm working on right now. And, prior to COVID, a really wonderful thing is that, really massive companies have reached out to me about doing workshops based on the research revealed in the work chapter. And I think that that's a great sign for shifts in the corporate space. And then I'm also working one-on-one with men who read the book and want to sort of incorporate some of the lessons and behaviors into their everyday life. It's really wonderful. Wonderful to see.
Yeah. There are a lot of guys out there who want to be better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't hear about that a lot. We hear about all the scumbags, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There are truly a lot of really, you can kind of get like a little patronizing, a little cheesy, but I'm a very genuine person. And I do really mean it. Like, you know, there are so many men really wanting to step up to the plate. And it's so, I have just so much gratitude for them.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, because you approached the book the way that you did, and, I mean, this is something that I've been writing about and given a lot of thought for over a decade, really, you know, and it started when I went through a divorce. That's what really, because I started to look at how was I showing up as a man in this relation, or not showing up, really, was the question, because all of this stuff that we're talking about is really relevant in our relationships with women. If we can't tap into our power and be grounded, then it doesn't work out all that well.
Do you mind if I ask if the work that you've done in sort of healing yourself after your divorce, have you had conversations with your ex about that at all?
I'll just say that we did everything we possibly could to keep that marriage. Yeah. And I didn't walk away until I knew I had done everything I possibly could. And I there was nothing more to do. But kind of the tail end of that involved therapists. And the tail end of that was a therapist who helped me see. He knew men's work. He was familiar with a book by Robert Bly called Iron John. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
So I had read it. I even got a chance to meet Robert Bly one time, but this guy brought it to life for me. And I started to see how passive I was being, how I wasn't accepting responsibility for day-to-day decisions. And, you know, the way I was going through life was, you know, I thought I was being easygoing, and and what I was really being was passive. And it was actually putting more of a burden on her because I forced her to make decisions. You know, I put her in a position to make decisions where when I was just, being the good guy, Tom, who was just agreeable, like, I'll do whatever you want, which, you know, that's not what women want from us. You know, men are supposed to be decisive. I believe. So does that answer your question adequately?
I mean, if we were just starting the interview, I would definitely ask more.
I don't know. When you go through that stuff, you know, it's like, okay, we've had enough conversations.
Yeah, about that's all enough. This stuff.
I did start to go into other relationships and started to evaluate, how am I showing up now? Why am I doing this again? I said I was never going to do this again, but it's hard, man. Relationships are hard. And so going back to this stuff, guys not talking, like, how do you do that? How do you not talk about this stuff? And I, you know, it's listening to you, a lot of, I have five older sisters. I'm the youngest of eight kids. And I often think about how much that has shaped my point of view in life. You know, I was always the friend who did have deeper conversations. And the locker room stuff, I mean, I'm not going to say I've never engaged in it, but like, I never liked it. Like, it never, you know, once I got, you know, you cross into that age of awareness between like 11 and 13 somewhere. And like, as soon as I kind of came of age, like, I didn't talk like that about women, you know, and part of it was because of my sisters. And, you know, I think I became like kind of acutely aware of misogyny and not ever wanting to be seen as a creep, you know, was always important to me, you know? So we're looking at a possible television series, workshops. It's really interesting that you're working with guys too. I think that's cool. So this has taught you a lot, this book, right?
A huge amount, a tremendous amount. Very grateful for the experience.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm sure you'll publish another book and you're going to go on to do great things. And I really appreciate your time. And anytime you want to come back, I mean, we'd love to have you on here. But given what you've learned, especially in the context of writing this book, if there was a time when you could go back to the younger Cleo and give her a word of advice, when would that have been? And what would you say?
I would tell her, you're doing a very good job and you can really ease your grip on it just a little. you know how some people say about folks that they admire, like, how do you do it? You make it look so easy.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody who's ever worked with me has ever said that to me. I'm one of those people, like, it will come together well and it will do well, but there is nothing about my process that is easy or graceful or fluid. And I think that, you know, I punish myself. I'm better at it now, but as a young person, I've been very hard on myself, and I don't think that was necessary.
So is it perfectionism?
Yeah, it's perfection. Well, I don't know. I mean, I do a lot of therapy now, so it's a lot of things. It's a lot of things wrapped in there. Yeah. But yeah, a perfectionist kind of doer self, a fear that anxiety. Mine is, oh God, yeah. So, yes. Yeah,
it reminds me, you know, I did a personality test years ago, and it was in a college course, and I was telling this supervisor I had, and one of the traits that it described my personality as having is I tend to take on a lot more than I can handle and scramble around and figure out some way to get it all done. And she just laughed like, that's totally you. Like, I mean, it, and I don't do it as much anymore. I've learned how to pace myself, but you know, it was, you know, the intensity of that feeling overwhelmed, feeling like I have a million different balls in the air. It's like, I wasn't comfortable unless I was in that. And that's not really the case anymore. I like it better just like being able to breathe, you know?
Yeah. Amen. Yeah. Amen, my friend.
Well, Cleo, I really appreciate your time. Thank you for doing this, and hope we talk again soon.
I'm a huge fan of your work, so thank you again.
All right. Awesome. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk soon. Bye. Okay.
All right, there you go. Cleo Stiller. You can learn more about Cleo at cleostiller.net. You can find her book and her website through links in the show notes. Really appreciate her giving the time to the show. And look forward to feedback from you guys. You can call the show and leave a voice message at 561-247-4757. Love to hear from you. Comments, questions, recommendations. 561-247-4757. You can follow the show on Instagram or like us on Facebook, both at The Path to Authenticity. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can gain access to supplemental content and early access to episodes. Check out our Sunday playlist on Spotify. Also, if you're following us on Instagram, I'm doing some lives every week, usually with Ed Tilton. We've been trying to do it on Sunday afternoons at 3 o'clock Eastern. This week, we're doing it on Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. Trying out some different times, hoping maybe to get some people to engage a little bit. The next episode after this, Ed and I recorded with video at the same time that I was recording the audio of the podcast. So that can be found on the Path to Authenticity YouTube channel. I'm going to try to do more of that where, while I'm producing the show, also publishing a live stream. So, you know, just trying to shake things up, do things different, get some people to engage a little bit. Also working on a new website. There are a couple pieces I wrote related to this show. First, I made reference to something I wrote in response to the death of Anthony Bourdain. I'll leave a link for that in the show notes. And I also wrote a little piece about our interactions with Cleo. Again, link in the show notes. I appreciate you investing your time in this show. Thanks for listening. Please come back. Be nice. The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.